one into the night. Deep into right. Way out of here.
Swung on.
Bit crushed.
And the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch. Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
From WHYY, welcome to your Friday edition of Hittin' Season. I'm Justin Clue. I write for Baseball Prospectus, and I'm the author of Summer of the Cheap Wieners, what the 1941 Phillies were doing while Joe DiMaggio was making history. Available now. With me is Liz Rocher, the editor of Sabres Baseball Research Journal. Hello, Liz.
Hello, Justin.
Who would have thought, Liz, that after that lousy offensive showing against the Cubs, we'd find ourselves on the 50th anniversary of April 17th, 1976, when Mike Schmidt led the Phillies to a staggering 18-16 comeback win over the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field with four straight home runs and recording eight runs batted in. What a fun memory that would be if we were coming off a really resounding Phillies offensive performance against the Cubs, no less. I mean, wouldn't that be something if we could talk about that? We can't. I can't stress that enough. But wouldn't that be great if we could?
It writes itself. Unfortunately, we now have to write something entirely different.
Not entirely different from past conversations we've certainly had on this show, but I don't think I have to remind anyone that even with the off day yesterday, the Phillies have not had the sharpest start to the season. But we are not going to dive right in talking about the issues the Phillies have faced. We'll get to some questions about that. I'm going to lob some weighty questions at Liz and see how she responds in regards to a couple of key areas of the Phillies, problem areas, I guess you'd call them. But before that, we're going to talk about a team that things are going even worse. And yeah, it turns out the Mets are terrible. This is from the Mets blog Amazin' Av. Having scored 3.42 runs per game thus far this season, the Mets lineup has been the fourth worst in baseball at scoring. And while the Mets have been better at run prevention than run scoring, their 4.16 runs allowed per game is the 11th best rate in the league. Of the players who've made it at least 10 plate appearances for the team, only two are healthy and hitting above league average, Francisco Alvarez and Luis Robert Jr. Francisco Lindor ranks third on the team in hitting, and all of the remaining eight players taper off from there until Carson Benge and Brett Beatty wrap it up. With Juan Soto and Jared Young on the injured list, the Mets simply need the players in their lineup to drastically improve. You know, we've all been kind of like circling what's the problem and what's the answer, whether you're a Mets fan or a Phillies fan. And really, at the end of the day, we're at the point where that's kind of the only conclusion you can have. Well, it's time for these really good players to play better. That's generally what we kind of need to happen here. And yeah. The question then becomes, well, wait, can they play better? And that's what gets people so worked up. So, I mean, does it act as a salve to you at all, Liz, that you can turn off a Phillies game and, you know, they were playing on the West Coast for a little bit. The Mets were playing on the West Coast for a little bit there. So you could turn off the Phillies game. And if they lost frustratingly, you could tune in around 10:40 to check out the Dodgers play the Mets and pretty much crush them.
I'll admit it was entertaining because I watched really very little of this Cubs series. After I saw which way the wind was blowing in game two, I'm like, all right, game three will get my attention back if it's worth it. And then I didn't even bother. Did not even bother. It was just, this was a depressing series to watch, wasn't it? And I really did need a little bit of like Mets terribleness to at least remind me that, hey, baseball can be joyful, even if I'm finding joy at the expense of others.
It really is great, and it does a lot for you, especially since the Mets are, as we're recording, currently already down 4-0 in the second inning against the Cubs. But you do forget that there are other National League East teams, and things are going kind of well for the Atlanta Braves right now. And gosh, look who it is that the Phillies get to play this weekend at Citizens Bank Park. But yeah, we'll get to that in a second. I just wanted to mention that, you know, yeah, the Mets, those players I mentioned, they're all struggling, and it's bad. It's bad with the Mets right now. But the worst thing in New York baseball is, maybe you heard about this, turns out it's not the Mets batting order, it's not the Mets rotation, it's not the Mets bullpen. It's the music and sound effects at Yankee Stadium, which I don't know if you've heard. They're just too darn loud, according to Yankees fans interviewed in the New York Daily News. They were very eager to point out that these fans are young. So you're not talking to a bunch of fuddy-duddies. You're talking to 19-year-olds and 22-year-olds and 24-year-olds. And here's the thing. These people, I don't think they're wrong, but we'll hear what they have to say first. This is from the New York Daily News story. Plenty of fans have voiced their frustrations with the Yankees' infusion of synthetic sounds, which are blasted from a thunderous sound system and include rapid-fire song clips, horns, buzzers, the two-strike Star Wars siren. Yes, network analyst David Cohn calls that one a pregnant whale. Demands to make some noise, and on some nights, an actual DJ. And while such discord is hardly exclusive to the Bombers, who also lean heavily on an in-house organist, the topic as it pertains to Yankee Stadium has trended on social media a few times. It's been a subject on local sports talk radio, too. Well, hang on a minute. An issue being discussed, making it all the way to the hallowed halls of sports radio? Well, then this surely is a major issue of the day. But I will say, like I said, the issue, the article says, is that it's too loud and annoying for fans. And if that's what's going on based on what the fans are saying, yeah, I mean, I agree with the fans on that. That's really annoying and distracting. However, the players see it differently. Aaron Judge and the other Yankees, Jazz Chisholm's quoted in the article, too. They're saying that, yeah, when we're down on the field, we actually really can't hear a lot. And we want to hear some of this stuff. The article notes that Judge is the kind of guy who will visibly cue the PA person during batting practice to put on a new song or a specific song. So like that kind of stuff apparently is just really part of his process. And they're like, well, we need it loud because we want to hear it. And then that's helpful to us. And the fans are like, yeah, it's great that the players like it. One of them is quoted saying, but I think that the fan experience should take priority in this case, which is a hilarious sentence. But also, again, I'm not saying he doesn't have an argument. Another fan said, if you play well on the field, I will make noise. I promise you. You don't need to make it artificial and you don't need to ask me for it. That's a very, you may say that person's 22, but their soul is 78 years old. I'm sorry. And I'm not even saying that's a bad thing, but that is a very, like, they make sounds in stadiums. If the issue is the Yankees are doing it too much, I totally believe you. But they're going to make sounds in stadiums. You know, there's going to, they would never cut that out. They would just taper it back if they were to do anything. So that's not going to happen. But, you know, the music's too loud. Sounds like a hilarious complaint to have at a ballpark. But this is apparently a widespread enough issue, Liz, that people are talking about it. So on the one hand, fans want to have a good ballpark experience, and they can't do it with a bunch of frantic sounds being blasted at them every second. But on the other hand, Liz, I think it's good when Yankees fans feel bad. So where are you on this issue?
Excuse me. I mean, I'm all about the Yankees fans feeling bad. I believe I'm on the record numerous times arguing that. I can't help but agree that, like, sometimes it gets egregious, and it would be nice to be able to have a conversation with my husband, who can hear fully, mostly, and my father, who can hear a little bit less. Like, it would be really nice to be able to have conversations with them at ballparks without shouting all the time. But, you know, what the players want is important. Like, it's an easy solution, honestly. You just aim some speakers more at the field, you know, and quiet the other stuff down. Like, you don't have, you can reduce it. Yeah. Whatever it is, because, like, what the players want is important. Like, consider tennis. Tennis is, like, extreme in what they ask from their fans because it has to be pin drop quiet for either of the players to serve. Like, there's no music, there's no fan noise, there's nothing. And so, like, consider that. That's the extreme. There's definitely somewhere in the middle that we can fall here. There are so many different ways to improve this and to change it. Like, just saying, you know, like the Yankees or whoever saying, that's fine. We really like it this way. We're just going to keep it this way. Like, that's not, like, an option. They have to come to the table with ideas because there's, like, so much middle ground to cover. And it's so easy to get some fan goodwill here.
Isn't New Yankee Stadium just a big conference room anyway? You know, they don't play.
Yes, like, I've never been there. I've heard it's
like
terrible.
A real baseball experience at this point. Like, it's not even old Yankee Stadium.
Like National Stadium,
history, but
also.
Oh yeah, yeah, exactly. So, that is a
giant conference room. That's such a great way to describe it.
I wanted to just give Yankees fans a chance to weigh in, but in case anybody needed to feel a little bit better, the Yankees fans are out there. They're suffering. They're suffering, guys. Their team is, in first place, I'm imagining. I actually haven't checked it. Oh, they're in second place behind the Rays, as one would expect at this point in the season. The Yankees are, like every team in baseball, within one or two games of .500. They're 10-9 and a game and a half back in the AL East. And, I mean, you know, hey, times are tough for the New York Yankees. More wins than losses. Music's a little too loud. When's it going to end? This might be the darkest chapter in New York Yankees history, Liz. And we got to give these people the sympathy they deserve.
We do. I mean, it's definitely the darkest chapter that most of these people can remember. The people complaining about it. I mean, any of them, like, alive? Most of the people weren't even alive for the Yankees last World Series in 2009.
Well,
these are 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds. Some of them weren't they weren't even conscious for that.
I was going to say, a 24-year-old was born after that late 90s golden era. A 19-year-old was born in 2007. So they were alive.
Yeah. No, they were alive, yes.
They were not cognizant, you know, of the. Yeah, these are people who have never seen a Yankees World Series title. Can you believe that? No. Scary stuff.
And yet they still have such a sense of entitlement, you know.
Well,
it's
it's
a marvel. Like they've seen. It's like truly. Dallas fans. Like they've seen nothing. And yet they still feel like they have the gravitas within the football community to complain like it means something. Like, no, 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 no. Get to the back of the line. You guys suck.
Well, to be fair, you're talking about a lot of the same people. But yeah, let's move on to the Philadelphia Phillies. And there are many, many questions. I think these days off, these Thursday travel days, are doing people a lot of good. Give them some time to think about other things than the Phillies' frustrating beginning. I don't know about you, Liz, but Flyers in six, for sure. I feel like with other things to focus on and no baseball games in the middle of the week, you know, you can just kind of forget for maybe just 24 hours that the Phillies are looking kind of sloppy to start things off. But no huge disasters, just a lot of questions, you know. And we say things like inconsistency in regards to some areas. The truth is, we don't know what is or isn't consistent about the 2026 team yet, because they just haven't had enough time to establish what's normal for them. Now, you can look at this team and say, well, it's not early because we've watched basically the same group of guys have this basically same group of issues. And we said that on the last roundtable episode of Hittin' Season. However, this version of this team is still, you know, still has room to grow, still has room to improve. And I think in at least some of the areas where we've been hitting them, though they are going to, some more likely than others. But I thought I'd run down a list of specific issues or players, just kind of lay it out, and then we can just talk about exactly what we think is going to happen next, or what could happen next, or how it could happen next, and just kind of envision a more successful future for some of the Phillies' bigger issues. And actually, this first one, I'm not even going to say is that much bigger of an issue. It just kind of deals with a new part of the game in 2026. And that new part is that JT Realmuto is 6-for-7 in catcher challenges so far this year under the new automated ball and strike system. This is a new skill for catchers to be sharpening. And we heaped a lot of credit onto JT for having it. And trust me, I certainly did in the offseason, learning that this was going to be now a part of his duties, and the Phillies saying, like, yeah, we're not really going to be leaning on pitchers to challenge their own pitches. We're going to be leaning on the catchers. And it seemed like something JT could be good at without having to, like, be at a greater physical risk, which as a catcher in his mid-30s, you know, it's obviously on your mind. So you're like, great, he gets to use his brain, his catcher's brain, his field general's brain, his strategist's brain. That's a huge strength for him. So as he showed this elegance in the usage of ABS in spring training, and in general possesses the experience to make great use of the challenge system like this to help his pitchers, 6-for-7 is great, However, Liz, it's not a lot compared to some of the others. Edgar Caro of the White Sox, he's made 25 challenges so far. He is 10 for 15.
Whoa.
William Contreras and Will Smith of the Brewers and Dodgers each have 21 challenges. They are 13 and 8 in those challenges. And Ryan Jeffers of the Twins is 12 for 20 on his catching challenges. So I think the question becomes, would you prefer, Liz, that JT Realmuto be strategic with a higher rate of success on catcher challenges, or go for more overturned calls despite the greater number of missed challenges that that could involve? Like, in short, when it comes to catcher challenges, would you rather quality or quantity?
I would actually say quantity, because if you, you know, you have a, unless you're really bad at it, with which JT is not, you have a fair chance, if you're not stupid, of maybe getting it right, what, half the time, let's say. Maybe even half the time. It's two options, you know, ball or strike. So I would rather him challenge more, because then at least there's, if you challenge more, then there's at least the chance that you'll get it right. If you're not challenging enough, if you're not challenging, then you don't even have the chance to get it right.
I mean, part of this that has to be mentioned is that based on how the system works, you're going to run out of challenges pretty quickly if you're going the quantity route and you're not good. So you kind of naturally have to be quality as part of the quantity argument.
I guess that's fair. Yeah, that's a good point.
But stats indicate that, as I just read, some catchers are just doing it three times as often as JT is. So I wonder, it kind of makes me wonder about his approach here. And I'm not criticizing it. This is just another dimension of the game. And to be honest, do you think we even know what it looks like? Like, what is a good catcher's success rate in this? Because like 6 of 7, yeah, that's solid. It's not a lot. 10 of 15. Does that sound bad right now? Because this is a whole new thing. This is a whole new component to baseball. So like, what is a bad version of this? Is this going to, like, by the end of the season, prove to be a challenging enough skill that, you know, missing 10 calls is going to be a lot or a little?
Yeah, I guess we don't really know. We're all trying to make judgments on something before we even know, like, the first set of defined outcomes. We're just sort of looking at it as it happens, which is, you know, the only way we have to look at it. But we have to remember that whatever proclamations we're making now could prove to be wrong in, you know, by the end of the season or maybe in 2 weeks. Like, because this is happening in, you know, what, 15 games a night or something, like, you know, at most 15 games a night. And there's what, how many does each team get? Two. And so that's what, 4 per game. Like, that's a lot of challenges per night if everyone's using the most.
And if you're getting it overturned, then you're keeping it. So it's more challenges every night. So, yeah.
Exactly.
I feel like maybe we're learning a little bit about JT's approach to this, honestly. Just that,
yes, we are.
He's maybe being very sure of himself before he overturns. Because the other night, I believe I saw the one where he was not successful of those 7. And it wasn't a strong reaction, but there was a definite facial reaction. I would say on the same level when he was watching Jared What's-His-Face run in from the bullpen. And he claimed later that he wasn't rolling his eyes in disgust at that. But I will maintain forever that he was just like, like, about that. It was on the same kind of level facially. And for JT, that's pretty strong. Pretty strong reaction to something. So I think if I had to guess, I'd say he's putting a lot of pressure on himself to nail this. And I think when the season started, I wouldn't be surprised to learn, we never will, but I wouldn't be surprised to learn that Realmuto had the intention of 100% success rate on challenges. So I don't know. We'll see. We'll see if it's more valuable for somebody to take a more careful approach and be right more of the time, or, you know, do more of a scattershot and just be like, hey, all right, you know, the more I'm challenging, the more likely it is. Like, if I don't challenge, it's definitely not getting overturned. So maybe my approach is just that I'm going to do it whenever I think it's close.
Yeah. And I think whether you watch the TV or you listen to the radio, the announcers are actually a really good gauge of this, because they have at least at times mentioned, well, that would have been maybe a good pitch to challenge. That looks a little questionable. And it just sort of goes by. And paying attention to that has really helped me sort of see, at least on other broadcasts, you know, what other catchers are doing and how frequently they're doing it, whether or not they're listening to their pitchers. if a pitcher says, hey, that looked a little sus, you know, maybe JT should listen to that a little bit more instead of, you know, my reflex and yours completely not listening to the pitchers at all.
That's exactly what I was thinking while you were talking. I was like, if that pitcher, if we had like a sign where the pitcher's like signing to me, like, oh, can you challenge that one? Eventually, I'd just start ignoring it because it would be the same thing as him slapping himself in the back of the head every time. It's like, no, just shut up. Like, it was bad. Yeah, I missed the zone. Move on. Next pitch. Let's go. What's funny is that was going to be a JT Realmuto offense question, but maybe this kind of approach is a question in and of itself, Liz. Maybe you agree with this. I ultimately decided not to do a JT Realmuto offense question because I think I'm at the point there where he's either going to hit or he's not. And it's time to judge him on the barometer of being a good catcher and maybe not so much being a good hitter. Like, I want him to be a good hitter and he should hit, you know, a certain amount. There would be a level at which it would be totally unacceptable. But he's not there yet. He's just, you know, he's not going to hit 300, man. He's probably not going to hit 280 either. Like, he's hitting 273 currently, which, you know, is not bad. But, I think JT's a guy who people have wanted to see a little more from offensively. But I think that just comes down to thinking about how good he used to be at everything in the game. And the truth is, he's just now 35 and some aspects of it. He's not, bat speed's dropped a little bit and he's not making as hard contact as he used to. So, I don't know. I feel like with JT specifically, like I said, he's going to hit or he's not. So I'd rather just talk about the catching component because that's, at the end of the day, a more important part of his job. Yeah.
Like, some teams get no offense from their catchers at all. And that's just the way it is for them. Getting what we get out of JT is always a plus for me. You know, we remember how it was, and that was, like, incredible. But even capturing him, you know, for the contract he has now, and maybe for another year or two beyond it if he wants, would not be a bad thing. Like, everyone's like, let's get a better hitting catcher. I'm like, where? Where are they? JT's the best we've got, and he's a great catcher. Like, he's a great catcher who provides offense, period. And so I think you're right. I think it's time to stop, you know, at least to judge him a little bit more gently. Because he's still, I mean, he's going to catch, what, 130 games this year, unless he's hurt. I mean, maybe. Probably more than that.
Yeah, well, no, that's, yeah. This is the year
that's the thing.
They've said before, we're going to have him back off, but I don't think any of us bought that this year. So you're right. No. It'll be like 130 at least.
Exactly. And like, there aren't a lot of catchers who could do that, period. And JT is one of them. And so, you know, it sort of puts everybody's, you know, off-season agita about JT Realmuto into perspective, because now that he's playing and there's this new aspect of the game, it makes him even more valuable, you know, to the Phillies as a pure catcher, as just a catcher in the position. So, it's sort of nice to see him, I guess, vindicated in a way. Like, you should, you know, I'm not going to be upset that everyone's sort of disappointed, but yeah, you should have been thrilled to have me back because I'm great.
Remember that? Oh, boy. All right, Liz, who do you want to talk about next? Do you want to talk about Jesus Luzardo? Do you want to talk about Alec Bohm? Or do you want to talk about Adolis Garcia?
Let's have a look at... Let's do some Alec Bohm. I don't want to talk about Jesus Luzardo yet. I don't want to talk about him yet.
Alec Bohm!
Oh, my God, I just saw his cumulative ERA. It's very bad.
Alec Bohm, the boy the Phillies couldn't trade, is hitting 145 through his first 17 games of the season with just two extra base hits and 10 runs batted in. As we all know, he's suing his parents. He just fired his agent, Scott Boris, per The Athletic. Obviously, on a personal level, this is atrocious. On a baseball level, well, who knows if his lousy start is exclusively because of this, or at least partially, and how much is just Bohm normally struggling? You know, is this like an early season stagnant period that's being exacerbated by what's going on off the field? Is this, I feel like that's a pretty solid guess. Lachlan March of the Inquirer, she and Scott Lauber did an article about things you might be overreacting to right now, things you might not be overreacting to right now, just because the Phillies have that many things at the moment. And she was saying that Alec Bohm's early start isn't necessarily something you need to be concerned about. But her proof of that was simply that Brandon Marsh's numbers at the start of last year were so, so bad. He hit like 0.95 in April. And now he's one of the team's most effective hitters, perhaps the best. So the point was that a guy can dig out from a hole this deep after a really, really rough start. But let's just skip ahead here. How do you see the Alec Bohm situation ending, Liz? Like, does it end this year? Like, win or lose against his parents, he's still got a season of baseball to play. And that's not, I'm not saying I'm not sympathetic to the issue. It's just, it's kind of just an objective truth. So how do you see the Alec Bohm situation like playing out here in Philadelphia? Is this his last year in Philadelphia? Does he get through his last year in Philadelphia? Because at the same time, you may want to be rid of him, but as we know, that doesn't mean anybody's calling to acquire him. So
I think this won't be his last year, but it's probably one of his last years. Because, I mean, the Phillies don't have an immediate solution at third base, I don't think. Unless I'm forgetting something, which I could be.
Can I ask you a question before we get into the rest of the Bohm stuff real quick?
Mm-hmm.
Why does it feel like everywhere the Phillies could improve, the answer is, well, that's just simply not a person who exists. So, like, there's not a better catcher than JT Realmuto. I'm not saying there is, but like, okay, we had to get JT back. Alec Bohm, well, there's simply no way to move on at the moment from this person. And I guess it's kind of true because you can't trade him. And this would be an odd time to be giving up on someone. You know, it's mid-April. And then the offseason, like, again, I guess nobody was interested. And it just feels like every time you're trying to improve the Phillies, you just run into a wall. Like, why don't they have a true center fielder? I mean, now they have Justin Crawford and things are looking positive. But for so long, it was like, why don't we have a true center fielder? Why aren't there, are there none out there? Why don't they have a cleanup hitter? Why don't they have a right-handed power bat? Is it because they keep doing things and then they're the wrong thing? But it just feels like there's a frustrating amount of times where the answer is simply, well, nothing can be done. Is that just team propaganda? Or like, is that you look around the landscape and you're like, yeah, kind of there is.
I mean, for some of it, it's that the guys that they want are already the guys that they have, and they're just not doing well enough. Like, if one of these,
answer, yeah.
Yeah, there's that. That's kind of the thing. Like, and like the Phillies are prioritizing what they have to. But, like, we want them to get a cleanup hitter. If any of these guys in the top of the lineup was doing well enough, they could be. But they're not. And so that it remains a problem. Like, if there is a great third baseman out there, like, the Phillies, I have a feeling we'll try and go get him. But I feel like does Aiden Miller, I know he's a shortstop, but are they going to slot him
people
at
generally
third base?
View him as like an infielder at the moment. I think if you really drilled down, you'd see that like there's areas he's expected to be better at, like based on his arm and based on his range and everything. But I don't know. I'm sure there are people, you could find some people who are like, and then you just put Aiden Miller at third base because he's an infielder and all the positions are the same. You know, it's the same kind of deal. My thinking is always, especially with like, and I guess we'll get into this more with Adolis Garcia, but they're like, oh, they need a right-handed power bat. Isn't the majority of the human population right-handed? And don't a lot of baseball players hit the power? Is it really that hard to find a guy whose dominant hand is right and hits home runs, hits like 25, 20 home runs? Like, is that really that mystifying a concept? And it's like, obviously it's not Alec Bohm. And you mentioned, is there a great third baseman out there to replace him with? I think that's something else people step in regards to Bohm and other areas where the Phillies could improve, is that you don't really have to get a great player. You get one you think is going to be better. It doesn't even have to be somebody who is better currently. It could be a younger player you expect to become better, or even just somebody who's maybe on the same level as Bohm, but but like veers more like, oh yeah, but he has a great arm or something, like where he excels at something, where Alec Bohm is pretty average across the board. So like maybe a guy who, yeah, he's an even worse hitter than Bohm, but he's a way better fielder. Like you can try different things like that. You don't have to replace everyone on your team who's an average player with an all-star, because that is unreasonable, but that's not the answer every time.
Well, I mean, how Alec Bohm does this year is going to, I think, calibrate what they're looking for at third base in the future, because he's just a free agent after this year, I think. And that's a great way to get rid of him, is just to not sign him to a new contract. And you just sort of escape that whole, are they going to trade him? Like, no, they're not. They can't trade him anywhere. There's no one who wants him. That's the thing. Someone's going to sign him. And that's the problem with the open market, is you can get some of those guys, but a lot of them are tied up in small two-year contracts. When they come back on the scene, they want more. And so those guys are more expensive than you would remember. Like, why don't the Phillies have one of those guys? I'm like, yeah, but where are they? Where were they?
What if Alec Bohm hit 200 in the first, and you're right, he's on a one-year deal for $10.2 million this year. What if Alec Bohm hit like 200 in the first half? Let's actually make a look. What if Alec Bohm hit 180 in the first half of the season? I guess if he did that, they would probably they'd be more aggressively looking for other solutions. What I'm just trying to set up here is, what if he had like a pretty lousy first half, but then a really good second half? Are you thinking, because other options are not so readily available to replace him now, that at that point you're like, well, now he's playing well, and he played well over an extended period of time, might as well bring him back?
Yeah. You also kind of run the risk with any other player you sign. Right?
Yeah, but the point is that you know Alec Bohm, and you've got a front row seat to his Alec Bohm-ness over the past few years. Are you looking at a second half where he hits 300 and saying like, okay, this is the new Alec Bohm? Or do you feel like you know enough to be like, yeah, but then we're going to come into spring training and who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. And I guess it would at least be more interesting to do that with a different player who has better potential. Right?
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. So I guess if we're judging on potential, yeah, I'm guessing they could definitely find someone better. They're not looking for potential anymore. They need established guys because they want to win a World Series. Now, the easy way for them to do that is to spend more money, which they don't want to do, which is why we're here. It's just in general. Just remember that. Most of the time when we have these arguments, it's because there was someone available to sign, perhaps, and the Phillies either got, you know, snubbed, or they just didn't offer enough and weren't even in on them. That's a disappointing thing, is that you just get the sense they're not in on a lot of the guys you want them to get to sub, you know, but to be a new player at, like, third base.
So I guess this all just brings us back to the original question, which was, with everything Alec Bohm's going through off the field and how bad his numbers have been on the field, how do you see this ending up for Alec Bohm this year? Is he on the team next year? Because obviously there probably won't even be baseball next year. So like, just in general, how do things end up for Bohm this year? If this wound up being the last year he was in Philadelphia, how does the fan base think of him when he's departing?
I think it'll be largely positive. I think mostly because I think that's a good way to say it. You know, he's had some ups and downs, but largely he's been memorable. You know, he's been really memorable. And, you know, the Phillies brought him up from the minors. It's like one of their own players that played out the whole string with the Phillies. You can't say they didn't give him a chance fully.
A position player who came out of the Phillies farm system and played a significant role on several postseason teams for the Phillies. Yeah. That is a rarity. That alone makes Alec Boehm a unicorn.
Exactly. And that's kind of what I'm saying. Like, I don't think they will stick with him, but if they did, I wouldn't blame them, because depending on what the other options are, they would rather stick with the player they know than someone they don't, which is why the team looks like this year. Because they looked at the other options out there and said either they're overpriced or we have the same player. They're just not playing well. Unfortunately, that's continued to happen.
Yes. Unfortunately, I do think the definition we have of Alec Boehm is accurate and you can trust it. I do hope, and I actually think he's certainly better than the numbers he's putting out there right now, but
completely.
I certainly hope that he's playing better, you know, after the next couple of weeks. I don't know. Like, I think this thing with his parents, there's going to be, I think I read there's going to be like another hearing or some kind of milestone in the ongoing process in like 6 weeks or something. So I don't know.
I bet it's discovery or something. Ooh.
Yeah, like who knows? I don't. Yeah, I really don't. This feels like it's already too public of a very personal issue.
I wish we didn't know about it. I'm sorry it's happening to him.
Yeah.
But God, I wish we didn't know about it.
Yeah, and imagine if he was just hitting 145 and then there was no further caveat that you could point out. Like, yeah, that it's not like people would be more understanding in that situation.
Yeah, that's true.
But I think there's a better Alec Boehm than this that the Phillies are going to see for sure. But even then, you know, we know who we got here. And I hope he's able to be the player that the Phillies kind of need in that role. But, you know, history has taught us that every version of that in which he has done so has been fleeting. So we'll see what happens. I'm thinking Boehm does crawl out of this hole at some point. I'm feeling like he's got a second half resurgence of sorts in him. You know, even if it's just like a hot 3 weeks, I think there's more in store for Alec Boehm. He'll get a little more straightened out. But all in all, just a bummer to start the season.
Yeah.
All right. Do you want to move on to Jesus Luzardo or Adolis Garcia?
Let's talk about Jesus. let's do it.
Let's get it out of the way. There's no more annoying practice, Liz, than looking at a player's stat sheet, deciding to remove the two or three worst stats, and then saying how good he is without his worst performances. But in the case of Jesus Luzardo, it's kind of tough not to be a complete and total dictionary definition of a hypocrite. We all remember the 20 earned runs he gave up in two back-to-back starts last year that ended in the Phillies determining that Luzardo was tipping his pitches. And they were right, and things turned around, and those starts were truly outliers to the rest of his season. In 32 starts last year, Jesus Luzardo gave up over 4 earned runs only 4 times in 32 starts. 2 of which being the starts I just mentioned, in which he gave up 12 and 8 runs. So they are very much outliers, more cartoonishly so than I think when this practice is typically employed. So this year, Jesus has racked up 20 earned runs, 28 hits in 22 and two-thirds innings. That is a 794 ERA. We all saw what happened last time when the Cubs lit him up, and this is a guy the Phillies just extended to keep a part of their rotation for years, as well as a pitcher who received National League Cy Young votes last year. He finished 7th. We've seen Christopher Sanchez, Aaron Nola, and Andrew Painter struggle this year. And watching Taiwan Walker pitch is often more of a struggle for the viewer, I would argue. Is Jesus Luzardo part of the inconsistency with the Phillies rotation right now, Liz, or do you view him as kind of a solution, the guy who will correct himself before the others because we've watched him do it before?
We've watched him do it before, but we're all just waiting for him to do it. So just do it. Get better. And that's kind of, that illuminates the whole issue in general, because, you know, he did it before, but until he does it this time, he hasn't done it again. He's only done it once. And so it's a little nerve-wracking watching him. He is definitely an inconsistency issue right now. You just have to hope that he'll correct it, right? I can't count my chickens. I'm done doing that.
Did you see his post-game press conference after
last
start? It was very funny because they didn't ask. He just let off prior to any questions, I'm not tipping my pitches. And they talked about how I think the word was tirelessly. He and the Phillies worked on purging him of tipping pitches. So I just imagine, like, I wonder what crazy boot camp they had with Jesus Luzardo.
I know.
Where they just, like, took him out to the desert and made him pitch and pitch and pitch until no one could guess what kind of pitch he was going to throw next. And he was like, he gets back now, and he's just flashing back to that time of his life. And before anybody can ask, which definitely would have been, you know, one of the first questions, one of the first two questions at least would have been, hey, do you think you're tipping your pitches? Because that's what it was last time. And he was like, nope, not tipping my pitches. And nope. They're like, no, he's totally healthy. So I know some people will take that as, oh, so this is worse news. But I mean, that has to actually be better news, right? Especially with John Stolness in our last roundtable laid it out that, like, yeah, you could make the argument statistically, a lot of his stuff is actually better than last year. And his luck is through the roof bad, again, statistically. So that, I think, these are all indicators that he's a good pitcher who is not pitching poorly, but seeing poor results, I think, a lot of the time.
Yeah, his FIP, his fielding independent pitching, is 2.90. Like, that's he is getting, I would say, pretty unlucky right now. I do have the image of him not in the desert, but you know that it's a scene in the movie Miracle. It actually happened to the 1980 USA hockey team. But when they, their coach was unhappy with them, and so they spent like hours doing skate back and forth, till some of them threw up and fell down. I'm imagining the Jesus Luzardo version of this, with his arm just sort of hanging limp by the end of it. He's just sort of like, get up.
We are going to do up downs until you are no longer tired or thirsty, because that's from Remember the Titans. That scene is in every sports movie.
Yep,
and they're just having him. Anyway. They're having him do that, but yeah, it's just, he's just like not even pitching. He's just standing there, like going into his delivery without giving off too many indicators. Like, that's the whole process.
Yep.
Jesus is throwing fewer four-seamers and more sinkers this year. His sweeper is now his most used pitch instead of the four-seamer, which was before. He also, and this is the main thing for me, he also can't seem to pitch with runners on base, which is more of a classic Aaron Nola problem,
yeah.
Which is why it's alarming to me. Joe Ettinger on The Good Fight writes, opposing hitters are hitting 441 with 5 extra base hits, including 3 home runs against Luzardo with runners on base. So, I mean, you know, I'm not going to say maybe he's tipping because he's so adamant that he's not. But again, with runners on base.
I was just going to say, though.
Tripping. But in any case, leave it alone. He's going to yell at us.
Someone's giving signals to the hitter. That's what it is. If it's when guys are on base, it's not because you can't focus with guys on base. It's because the guy behind you or to the side of you can see what you're doing. God.
It would be really funny if it turned out to be that he was tipping his pitches at this
point. I know.
Very funny. But also, I think with Jesus Luzardo, the misses are usually so hilariously off. That it's comforting. That you're like, well, this not only must be corrected, it will be. Like, they're looking for something they know they're gonna find. You know, it's not a needle in a haystack. It's, you know,
very, very obvious, whatever it is.
You know, yeah, you're gonna find it. It might be a little tough, but you're gonna find it. And, you know, they will. I think this gets corrected. So I feel like Jesus has been one of the more frustrating inconsistencies to watch, but I do think he is one that you can feel good about being corrected in the short term. Which,
yes,
brings us to our last player, Adolis Garcia. There's a question, because he's also kind of several other questions. Like, you know, as I mentioned before, where will the right-handed power come from, and who will bat cleanup? Questions people have had about this Phillies team that you'd think a guy you're bringing in like Adolis Garcia is pretty much born to fill that role. NBC Sports Philly had a little write-up on Garcia and his journey to the big leagues, in which Cole Weintraub pointed out a few interesting notes. He writes, last season, Garcia posted 16 defensive runs saved, the best mark among major league right fielders. last season, not even that 2023 season. That's like, you know, the one that everybody wants to get back. And this year in Philadelphia, he's already tallied 2 outfield assists. Oh, yeah. Did you see that assist where he got that that Cubs runner at third base? Did you see that?
Yes. Oh.
Yeah. So, like, that's the difference between having him and Nick Castellanos out there, by the way. Obviously, Castellanos had some assists in his day, for sure. But this is a normal Adolis Garcia move to be able to do that.
Yes.
So to continue the Cole Weintraub quote, his arm has been a huge difference maker, sitting at 94.2 miles an hour on average, which ranks in the top 2% among outfielders. That alone gives the Phillies an element of the game they did not have at that position a year ago. Phillies hitting coaches made clear in camp that they believed in Garcia's bat. He said the focus was on a few tweaks and adjustments, improving his pitch recognition, going after good pitches, and building from there. Now, that's the part that, like, you think about it, Garcia, I mean, my mind immediately goes to offense. I do have to always be reminded, yeah, but he's good at defense too. And you're like, oh, right, that's a net gain out there. That for sure is. And like I said, you've already seen what that arm can do. So, you know, obviously you want him to be able to hit like Adolis Garcia has hit in the past. That's going to do a lot for him. But the defense, you can't talk about him without talking about the defense, because it truly is a very high level of defense to be getting out there in an area where the Phillies had, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, was Castellanos not rated the worst defender in all of baseball? Like, this is a huge improvement. So you got to give credit where credit's due.
Yes, yeah. I'm happy to give credit where it's due. I mean, and I'm not even, we're going to talk about his offense next maybe, but like I'm not even really all that unhappy with that. He'd hit 19 home runs this last year. He hit 2 this year. Like, I don't expect him to be like significantly better than he was last year. Is that wrong? Should I not be like, because this is who he is. This is him.
I think the general belief, like within the Phillies or even the fans, is people are, like I kind of referenced earlier, are chasing that 2023 season when he was an all-star. He won a gold glove and he got some, you know, not a lot, but some MVP nods. And to your point, he hit 245 that season. So obviously that's not the number you're worried about. He's hitting 231 right now. It's the slugging that you're worried about. He slugged 836. Or I'm sorry, his OPS was 836. If he's slugging 836, he'd be in the Hall of Fame already. He slugged 508. You want to see that slugging for him be 500 or more. That's what you want, or at least close to that. You know, that's what you want to see from him. That's when you're getting that right-handed power and potential cleanup guy that you hoped you were getting when you signed him to a 1-year, $10 million deal. And the good news is, his chase rate is lower than its worst state in 2025, and his in-zone contact is at a higher career is at a career high at the moment, with his hard hit rate even higher than it was in 2023. And this is from Weintraub's write-up. In 2023, Garcia's chase rate was 29.3%. By 2025, it had ballooned to 35.7%. That is quite the jump. This season, it is back down to 30.5%. So, you know, that's good. That's quite a lot. That means he was definitely over swinging at that time, and he's definitely at least cut some of that out. His in-zone contact has jumped to a career high 87.5%, and his hard hit rate is running about 3 points higher than his 2023 numbers. So these are all characterized as positive signs, and I think they also, they fall into the same category as some of the numbers that you see from Jesus Luzardo, where you're like, these numbers indicate that he's pitching well. The outcome numbers indicate that he's not, which means that there's some other stuff going on, and that you can attribute luck or timing. I know just anecdotally, I've seen Adolis Garcia smoke a lot of like just line drives and fly balls this season, and somebody's caught him. And eventually that'll stop happening. So I do think, you know, those are, I didn't mean for this to turn into like just rosy colored optimism hour, but like, I think that is something to consider positive. It sure would be nice and easy, Liz, if Garcia became a real hitter in this lineup, like a real hitter. But the issue wasn't that Garcia was, again, swinging and missing. It was that he was swinging and missing at fastballs due to a bat speed that our own John Stolness noted dropped from the top 25% in the sport to about mid-tier. Now, the answer to that, the response to that should be, the adjustment that you would make is to be more patient at the plate. And, you know, then you're going to draw more walks. But in general, you just want to be more patient, because I don't think Garcia is the kind of hitter that you want drawing a ton of walks. You want him driving in the runs from other guys who draw walks. So far, he's got a 6.8 walk percentage, which is higher than last year, but lower than most other years. Regardless of his progress, the Phillies need a right-handed power bat and a cleanup hitter. Maybe it's Garcia. Maybe it's someone else on the team. Maybe it's someone else entirely. Scott Lauber threw the name Isak Paredes out there in his recent write-up, if you want to get excited about somebody else. But it's early. Every game is shifting opinions more strongly than it will in August. But this weekend, the Phillies are set to face two lefties at Citizens Bank Park. And in 8 games against lefties at Citizens Bank Park this year, Adolis Garcia is hitting .417 with 2 doubles.
Mm.
In very limited sample sizes, Garcia has hit each of the 3 Braves starters individually this weekend. He's like 2-for-3 against one of them. He's 1-for-1 against another one. So it's not entirely not worth saying, but at the same time, in his opportunities to hit these guys, he's hit them. Grant Holmes and Reynaldo Lopez are issuing the most free passes among Braves pitchers. Holmes allowing 10 walks in 4 games. Not a ton, but it's possible to be patient and pounce on some slop with a deep count. Garcia's also got 4 hits in the last 6 games. So that's also something to look at. All this to say, Liz, what do you think we'll feel after this weekend? More that Garcia is another Dombrowski bumble, or that he could be the right-handed power bat or cleanup hitter this team needs? I'm not saying which one do we definitely know. I'm just asking, which side of that scale do you think we'll be closer to by the end of the weekend?
It depends on what your expectations were when he was signed. Because they said that he was a potential, like, you know, cleanup hitter. And I thought, not with the way he hit last year and even the year before. That's just not who he is. Like, what everyone wants him to repeat 2023, the closest he ever got to .508 before that was .456. He, you know, he's just not, I don't think he's the player that everyone wants him to be. I think what we've seen of him is actually what I hope we'll see from him for the rest of the season, maybe with a few more home runs. But the only time he hit, I mean, he never even hit, he hit 31 home runs in his first year, 27, then 39. And last year he hit 19. Like, if he can get up to a little bit over 20, that'll boost his slugging somewhat. But, like, I don't expect him to be, like, the big solution to anyone's problem. Because no matter what Dombrowski said, that's not why he was signed. He might have said that's why. But one look at his numbers, to me, at least, says that unless they're, like, expecting more from him than he's ever given or than he's, you know, ever produced, like, he's just not going to be that player.
Well, like I said, if the problem is the bat speed is lower, then the answer is a different approach at the plate. And then when you look at how he's chasing less, making more contact in the zone, and hitting the ball hard more often, I think you could say that he's made those adjustments. And like I said, he's had a lot of hard ball outs. So whatever you're going to get from him, whatever you consider his ceiling, I think you can look forward to seeing that pretty soon too, because, you know, he doesn't look lost out there. Some of these guys go up to the plate and they just look completely lost. Garcia doesn't look like he doesn't know what he's doing there. He just looks like he's been hitting into some outs, and that's, you know, on the stat sheet, that's just going to look like an out. But based on these peripherals, I feel like you can see, you know, he might be somebody that's able to at least knock some runs in, even if it's just a temporary solution, as the guy providing right-handed power. So we'll see. But, you know, again, as frustrating as it's been, the hints are there that a better Phillies team is possible, Liz. And just to give you a quick update, the Mets are now losing 7-3. So, like I said, better things are possible. And speaking of the Mets, as Phillies and Mets fans are talking about the futures of their respective managers, Rob Thompson and Carlos Mendoza, should current trends continue for each respective team, the Braves are happy and fine with their new manager, Walt Weiss. Maybe because he's been a coach in Atlanta for years and all the players know and like him already, so he was basically a natural fit. Maybe a guy they... Maybe he's a guy that they like who makes everyone comfortable and is exactly what a recuperating locker room of studs really needs to excel. The Braves have suffered plenty of injuries to key players like Spencer Strider, Spencer Schwellenbach, Sean Murphy, Ha-Seong Kim, and a bunch of relievers, but things are going well for the Braves right now. If you recall, Weiss recently made news by tackling Jorge Soler of the Angels during a bench-clearing brawl. Weiss's physicality has become a meme in Braves circles, and the incident got a lot of players laughing and talking about how much they respect him. Gabriel Burns writes in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, "All this has made it easier connecting with players as a coach. There's a reason the clubhouse was euphoric upon Weiss's promotion from bench coach to manager last November." So to me, this feels like what the Phillies, and who cares but the Mets, are also missing at the moment. One of these moments that just lets a gasp of personality and levity and looseness and enjoyment just come out. And everyone just remembers not just what to do, but how to do it and be successful. And just, are the Phillies going to get their Walt Weiss tackles Jorge Soler moment this season? Or do you think Rob Thompson gets in some hot water first?
I think he gets in some hot water. Do you see him something unexpected ever? Nope. I barely know. Like, most of the time I see him on the steps, mouth closed. Mm-hmm. Like, sometimes he is speaking, but I can't hear it. I forget what his voice sounds like or if he has one.
Yeah, he's definitely got the wait and see approach. He's definitely got a strategy that he sticks to. I'm not saying I know what it is. It's just, you know, based on like his approach to a certain player or a certain situation. I mean, we all know that. We all know that Rob Thompson has a plan. And I don't know. Think back to 2022, back when, you know, Tyrese Maxey is wearing the I Love Philly Rob shirt during Sixers warmups. And the players are immediately playing better under Rob Thompson than they were under Joe Girardi. And they all wore suits and the hats on the plane once, because he always wore that, so they all dressed up like him. Do you hear about a lot of stuff like that happening anymore?
No.
So
remember when they said we're not going to play songs in the locker room anymore after we win? I'm just like, okay. And in my head, I'm like, this feels like the end of something. And it took a little while to get there, but yeah, that's where we are.
I mean, I'm not telling Phillies players to put sparklers between all their toes and do cartwheels around the bases, or just everybody, hey, loosen up, because you know that can be like telling an insomniac to just get some sleep. Like, easier said than done. I do understand that, but I think just like with this 10,000 foot view we get here of the team and everything, an element like that can just be so valuable. And it doesn't have to be Rob Thompson tackling an opposing player. That would be amazing. But that's not something you should expect to happen. It's just something that reminds you that, like, look at all the very serious stuff the Phillies are going through right now. Zach Wheeler had a blood clot. His life was in danger. Bryce Harper is like going through a midlife crisis. Fan-based diagnosis. I don't know the man or have a personal relationship with him, but just from the outside looking in, I feel like something like that is going on. Alec Bohm and his family, like, there's some like dark elements on top of the overall messiness, or creating the overall messiness, like within this organization. Like I've said before, I think there's some screws loose in the engine that runs this team. We may never know what that stuff is. I don't know. Then we seem to always find out at least a little bit about what that stuff is way after the fact. But I don't know. It feels like at the very least, this team could really use a Walt Weiss tackles Jorge Soler kind of moment to just remind them of what that 2022 team did so well. I don't know. I guess I never truly, I did understand abandoning the whole like, oh yeah, this is like a serious, we're not the daycare anymore. Like, this is a serious team and we're going to be serious. I get at the time it was like, okay, well, we've tried this a couple of times and it hasn't worked. So we're going to, like, this year we're trying a different approach and we're going to be a little more buttoned up and a little more, you know, intense about things. And you're like, okay, hey, maybe that works too. And then that didn't work either. So now they just seem like a team that's not having a lot of fun. Truly,
yep.
You know, it wasn't like all the Phillies were on Team USA in the World Baseball Classic, but it just feels like a carryover of those same kind of vibes where it's just like, yeah, you chose the overly intense route. And I mean, you know, hey, that team went to the championship, but ultimately it didn't make them, I don't know, It feels like that's just a dimension of this team that they seem to have lost over the years. And I don't know how much Rob Thompson has to do with that. And I don't know how likely it is that he views that as something that, like, oh, I need to make something like that happen to loosen these guys up. I think the reason you saw them play so well when he first took over was that that having that hands-off approach was such a departure from Girardi, who maybe was detached, but also wasn't, you know, fun to play for. I'm just guessing based on vibes, that they were able to relax and have fun and play well. But I think his approach hasn't really changed. And maybe that was the best approach for 2022 and 2023, but maybe it's not the best approach anymore. So I don't know. Yeah. I'm not going to be the first one to call for Rob Thompson's job at all. And I don't, you know, again, it's April 17th. That shouldn't even be a conversation at the moment, but you know, it's been whispered about thus far because of the frustrating start. And you got a big contrast in Atlanta, where a team is doing very well in the NL East right now. And they can point to their player manager relationship as a very strong aspect of their team.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing much that can be done. Weirdly, like, the Phillies will have to make a decision to move on from to another manager. They likely won't do that till the end of the season because they respect Rob Thompson too much. It definitely in a different way than the way we heard Dombrowski respected Girardi, who he then fired like 2 weeks later. But like, they need to be shaken up, and I just don't see that happening. Like, they could get another manager next year, but who are they going to get? Whoever it is going to have to be deferential to Bryce Harper. And I think part of that is the issue. Like, a manager has to take all these other relationships into account instead of being like, nope, every player on my team is a player. No one is better than anyone else. You know, let's just do this. And that also seems to be missing and has been missing for a while, because it's obvious some guys get preferential treatment.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Atlanta, the Phillies will face the Braves this weekend. Unlike the Phillies and Mets, the Braves have found some rhythm early this season. They've proceeded to win all five series that they have played in so far, totally unbothered. Matt Olson and Ozzie Albies have started hot at the plate. New shortstop Mauricio Dubon has 22 hits in his first 18 games, including six doubles. DH Dom Smith has knocked in 15 runs, and future best catcher in baseball, I hate to say it, Drake Baldwin, has knocked in 19 runs with five homers, and oh yeah, he leads the National League in runs scored. Rotation's looking good for Atlanta, too. First four or five times through it, as you'd expect from Chris Sale and probably Reynaldo Lopez as well. But you're getting good stuff from Grant Holmes and Martin Perez as well. The real story, of course, is Bryce Elder, whose 0.77 ERA through his first four starts is making you glad he's not going to see the Phillies this weekend. ESPN writes he only got his job due to injuries in the Braves rotation due to the last few years when, quote, his ERA soared to 6.52 while making just 10 big league starts in 2024, followed by an 8-11 mark with a 5.30 ERA a year ago. Elder has paired an improved slider with a changeup and three different fastballs, a two-seamer, a four-seamer, and a cutter, to keep hitters off balance. Despite the lack of overpowering stuff, he's got like a 90 mile an hour fastball. He has 23 strikeouts and 23 and a third innings. So thankfully, like I said, none of that's relevant because Phillies aren't supposed to face Bryce Elder this weekend, thankfully. Atlanta's bullpen got some...
I would just say it's like the Braves are getting their Chris Sanchez and their Rob Thompson at once.
The bullpen's got some soft spots for the Braves as well, but if you've got to get a run off anyone of Raisel Iglesias, Dylan Lee, Tyler Kinley, or Robert Suarez, well, you're trying to get a run off four guys who've collectively only allowed three runs in 31 and a third innings this year. In seven games, Raisel Iglesias hasn't allowed a run at all. Are the Braves the kind of team you use to turn things around, Liz, and really get back into a good space? Before you answer, let me feed you these tidbits. Alec Bohm Trey Turner have crushed Martin Perez in the past. He's your game one starter tonight. And last year, Taijuan Walker made two appearances totaling 6.6 2/3 innings against Atlanta. He allowed six hits and five walks, but somehow did not allow a run. So that's... good news? Bohm, Turner, and Schwarber have great numbers against Chris Sale. Well, good to great numbers against Chris Sale. However, the Braves have pretty good numbers against Christopher Sanchez. So, yeah, like I said, Liz, if you're somebody hoping the Phillies turn it around this weekend, are the Braves the team you do that against?
No, that's not right. No, no, no. The Braves are a team that the rest of your first half is defined by. Like this, here's the thing. Whatever happens this weekend, this is the storyline for the next month. It's their first major test. The Braves are on a roll. They are stinking it up. And like no one knows what they're doing. They've got Chris Sanchez going, who's been hit around by the Braves, and they've got guys who are expected to do well against Braves pitchers, and so you know how that goes.
It would be very, very Phillies to lose a series to a lousy Giants team and a mid Diamondbacks team, and they lost that series to the Nationals, did they? Yeah, and they lost the series to the Nationals, who are projected to potentially be the worst team in baseball this year, and then come out and win a series or even sweep the Braves. I'm not saying that'll happen for any particular reason, though. You know, those reasons I listed are still reasons. But that would be, I think you'd make a lot of people feel good winning a series against the Braves this weekend. We shall see, though, because tonight at Citizens Bank Park at 6:40 p.m., you'll see Martin Perez, lefty. Some of the Phillies struggle with those more than others, facing Taijuan Walker and his 7.36 ERA. On Saturday at 7:15, you get the Aces, Chris Sale and Christopher Sanchez going mano a mano. And then Sunday in primetime at 7:20 p.m., you get Grant Holmes facing Andrew Painter in Game 3. So we shall see what happens with the Phillies and Braves this weekend. Could be interesting, could be devastating, but we'll be talking about it on our next roundtable episode of Hittin' Season with John Stolness. But that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to my co-host, Liz Rocher. You can get new episodes of Hittin' Season 3 times a week at billypenn.com/hittin'season, as well as anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also find bonus Phillies podcasts at the Hittin' Season Patreon at patreon.com/hittin'season. We actually have a new episode of our Phillies history show, The Dirty Inning, up this week about the 1916 Phillies, who sported a rare bunt-first offense. But they won like 90. I think they won like 91 games. So you know that's
awesome. 1916, that's dead ball for sure.
Coming off,
oh man,
the defending National League champions in that story too. So a story about Phillies history that's not about them being bad. That's worth a listen while you're doing yard work this weekend for sure. I'm Justin Clue, and from WHYY, that's the ballgame. We'll talk to you next time on Hittin' Season.